Dick Barton, Special Agent.
In early youth, it seemed to last forever, a birthright like holding a British passport. Each early evening, the dramatic music rolled, the cliffhanger was unhung. Then, in 711 editions, over a brief 5 years, it was gone.
I thought it was a tragedy. I was heartbroken. Absolutely. I did have a weep over it, definitely. And it takes a lot to make me weep. I don't do it easily. But I'm afraid I did weep that night, yes. Everything about that programme was a pure blend of perfection.
You're not getting away, Zettner.
Dick is forcing you over to the switchboard. You will both be electrocuted. We dare not shoot.
So you want to take me out with you, do you, Zettner?
Dick Barton was king of the golden age of radio. His 15-minute adventures ran from autumn to spring, from 1946 to 1951. At his peak, Dick Barton reached 15 million listeners a night. The streets emptied of children, who would be glued to their radio sets, soaking in every word and sound of the exploits of the super agent. Millions of adults listened too. Dick Barton was dreamed up shortly after the war as a kind of strip cartoon of radio by two senior BBC production men, John Macmillan and Norman Collins. Little did they know what a tiger they had by the tail. They entrusted the series to a young writer who stayed with Dick Barton, Special Agent, for 3 of its 5 years, Neil Tewson.
He was called originally Bill Barton. But you see, when you think about names, Dick Barton has a much stronger impact. Dick Barton, it got that punch to it. Mm. So that's how I think it came about. Norman Collins was the instigator. I was invited by Martin C. Webster to come along and produce it. He asked me one day to come to his office and he said, "We're doing a new serial. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Yes. Do you want me to write it?" He said, "No, I want you to produce it." Well, of course, I hadn't produced a thing in my life before that. Mind you, I'd done some broadcasting in Birmingham. But I had this thrown at me and I thoroughly enjoyed it. In fact, I'd lived the programme and I've never forgotten it. We did 2 test programmes in Birmingham because they hadn't got a studio available in Broadcasting House. We did the 2 water episodes with our fingers crossed. They were sent to the programme planners and apparently they liked them. I think what gave them the kick was my choosing the Devil's Gallop. I must say that was fun.
How did you come across that? Because that was an inspiration, wasn't it?
I went down to the bowels of the BBC, where they have everything, and I went through old classics, modern classics, you name it, I went through them, but I couldn't find an in and an out, if you know what I mean, you know, somebody to start the programme and somebody to finish it with, or, if you're a purist, with which to finish it. Anyway, I went through this, including some mood music, and at long last, I put this thing on, and I got it. I thought, that's it.
The Devil's Gallop, a household sound throughout the United Kingdom for 5 years, penned by Charles Williams, who, incidentally, proving his versatility, also wrote The Dream of Olwen. Altogether, there were 3 Dick Bartons. The first and by far longest serving was Noel Johnson. Martin C. Webster, having recruited Neil Tewson, selected Noel almost by accident.
It was at the end of, I think, The Three Musketeers with Marius Goring and people that Martin said to me over a drink in the Feathers pub in Warren Street, "Well, that's that out of the way," he said. "Now, I've just got this Daily Serial to set up before I go on leave." I said, "Daily Serial?" He put down his whiskey, and I can see it quite clearly in my mind now, and looked at me and said, "Why, would you like to be associated with it?" And those were his exact words. And I said, "What do you think? Work every day?" And he said, "We're going to experiment with a Daily Serial called Bill Barton, and it's going to be like nothing that's ever been done in this country before. There have been similar things on American radio, but not quite like this. And we think that you would be ideal for the part. Would you be interested? It won't pay an awful lot of money, But after an awful lot of haggling, I agreed to do it.
The budget for Barton was small. In the early years, at least, no more than £300 a week. And it was the question of cash which arose in 1949 when Noel Johnson left the cast.
Yes. I left series because I felt, putting it bluntly, I was underpaid. It's as simple as that. I could not get the BBC to realise that I was in the position, if you like, of a film star, so far as fan mail and popularity and whatever goes, with something like a fraction of a film star's earnings.
You had 2,000 fan letters a week and 15 million listeners a night.
Yes.
Do you think it went to your head?
No, I don't think it went to my head. This was something that one had obviously got to guard against. All I did know was that I was in that position, and yet I had less money in the bank than I had before I started the programme. And had, in fact, the BBC talked more reasonably financially, I would not have given it up.
Do you think the BBC behaved badly, then?
On that matter, yes, I do. Perhaps it's unwise to say so, I don't know. In point of fact, they did ask me to come back, having said to me, when I asked for more money, that any actor in London would give his eye teeth to play it, and that I needn't think that I was irreplaceable and all the rest of it. I said, I don't think I am irreplaceable. All I'm asking for is a little more money. I knew, for example, what certain people who were also very much in demand were getting, and it was a good deal more than I was. And when I mentioned one of these, they came back and they said, oh yes, but he's a variety act. You are just an actor.
All of which made way for a true-life tough guy, Dick Barton. Duncan Carse, the Antarctic exploration leader, who caught the imagination of the national press when selected for Barton by walking round London in January in an open-neck shirt. He was the new chum for Barton's sidekicks Jock Anderson and Snowy White.
I went through the usual vetting process. I had a run through with Alex McCrindle and Johnny Mann, Jock and Snowy, and there it was, Bob Durackville.
Duncan, you're very much a private man. In fact, I think some people would call you a loner. Wasn't it absolute hell to be an actor if you're such a private person?
I never really was an actor. I was someone who could act. And that's very different. The actor has a compulsion. I have none at all. The only time I was ever on stage was in Port Stanley in 1936. When we came up from the ice, we'd been 15 months in the ice, we came up with a case of appendicitis. So they put on a play, and I was cast as lead, and I suddenly found I could genuinely act. And I thought, this is rather nice, and I liked the applause, and then I sat back after it and thought, okay, you may be able to act, but I don't think applause and that sort of thing is very much good for you. Also, what you really like is exploring, so you will stick to exploring.
As Dick Barton, you must have become something of a celebrity. How did you handle that?
I think rather badly. I kept a very low profile. I wouldn't do things. I expect Alex McCrindle will remember this, that immediately there was an offer for the off-season of Would Dick Barton, Would Jock, Would Snowy, because Johnny Mann was alive then, of course, would we three go on the halls and do a turn? And I simply turned it down flat. I said, I'm sorry, I'm not someone who can do that kind of thing.
The other two Dick Bartons, have you met both of them?
Noel, yes, I certainly know. And send the best wishes, Noel, and thank you for yours. Gordon Davies, at the back of my mind, I think I have met. But I can't be sure, which is awful. Anyway, best wishes to you too, Gordon.
Which seems the right point to introduce Dick Barton number three, the youngest of the trio as a mere stripling of 69, Gordon Davies.
I knew that it was going on. I knew it was extremely popular. And it came the time when Duncan was leaving, and there was a lot of talk about auditions for a new Dick Barton. I was a bit short of work at the time. And I thought, oh, well, why not have a go at that then? So I went to my agent and said, I'd like to have a go on an audition for that. And my agent looked at me as if I was mad and said, well, if you insist. And I said, well, yes, I do insist. So I was put forward for an audition. And I went, and David Godfrey was taking the audition, as I remember, on, I can't remember now. I think it was Studio 4 or something like that on BH. And we did the audition.
Why do you think you got the job?
That is a mystery which you will have to ask the Iraqi at the BBC. I really don't know, because I understand there were some 500 people went into that audition. And so I can take it, as, if you like, as a compliment or just as a fact that my voice was complimentary to those who had gone before. I don't know, because I didn't try to imitate them or anything. I just went in, was given a script, and read it as I understood Dick Barton would read it.
Controversy raged round the bland Captain Barton. As more children became fans, so the programme was branded by the vocal dogs in mangers as a bad influence. For most of its run, it was on the air from 6:45 to 7 in the evenings, homework time. The veil which separates a teenage Dick Barton fan and a juvenile criminal is very thin indeed, thundered a correspondent to the Birmingham Gazette. Parents banned their children from listening, and one lad, at least, made an undercover set.
Well, it was a crystal set that I made in conjunction with my teacher. My mother didn't like me listening to Dick Barton, and so I had to do it secretly upstairs when I pretended I was doing my homework. And it was kept in my bedroom, under the bed, and it was a very simple device, really, mounted on a block of wood. There was, what I remember of it, a crystal and a little tuner thing. I think it's called a cat's whisker. You had to find a sensitive part on the crystal and throw an aerial out the window, and there you are. You had your radio. The reception, in actual fact, in London was superb, if you had a long enough aerial. And it was an addiction to me.
Dick Barton was an addiction to millions. He became an industry with books, three films, and a host of Dick Barton jokes, some of them true. A Sunday school teacher, and what more reliable source could you have, said she'd asked a small boy who'd created him. He said, God. So she went on, to whom would he turn if in trouble? There wasn't a flicker of hesitation. Dick Barton, he replied. And according to an Essex publican, there was at least one doctor who was a Barton alcoholic, in more than one sense of the word.
I used to arrive about 6 o'clock. I used to open the doors about 6:02 so I could serve him. Because he's a very impatient man. And Tom, I used to put in 2 pints of bitter before I ran round to open the public bar. And Tom, I got back, he had consumed those two. And in 15 minutes, he had consumed 7 pints. And he was always in a hurry to get back and listen to Dick Barton. And he always said different people drink for different reasons. So I suppose he had his own reason there.
And so to a veritable museum, a shrine even to Dick Barton. It's in Carlisle, and it's the home of Pat Hetherington, a lifelong devotee of Dick Barton. Pat, what's that enormous file you've got in front of you?
It's a 1,000-page file which has every episode of Dick Barton. It's the details of every episode of Dick Barton. There were 711 of them. I have the date of the recordings, when it was recorded, the date of broadcast, and the summary of the programme and who was in it and all the details. Little anomalies like no women in this episode, or Betsy Horrocks' first appearance, no Snowy in this episode. Different things.
And around the room we see all these pictures. Who have we got pictures of around here?
Noel Johnson, Duncan Carr, Gordon Davis, John Mann, Alec McCrindle, who played Jock and Snowy. I've got Neil Tewson, Raymond Rakes, and various combinations of all of them. I've got studio scenes. I can look at those pictures, and with a little bit of detective work, you can work out which episode it was if you know enough about them.
Pat Hetherington, who had the only known surviving tapes of a 2-week run of Dick Barton in 1972, and thus saved BBC Enterprises bacon so they could produce a commercial cassette, on the market now, incidentally. Pat, severely disabled, collected a BEM for her services to charity and treasures her Barton friends. One of these is Jock Anderson, or do I mean actor Alec McCrindle, one of Dick Barton's faithful protégés. Unlike Snowy White, who was in at the start, Jock was something of an afterthought.
Yes, sir?
Jean, is Jock Anderson about anywhere?
Yes, he's here in the outer office with me. Just come back from that job in the bank robbery.
Oh, yes, of course. How did they get on?
Caught his gang. Jock's a bit beaten up, but he's all right. He always is.
Yes, I know. Will you ask him to come in and see me right away?
You're wanted, Jock.
See what you think, Barton. Might be an idea.
Hello, sir. You want to see me?
Yes, Jock. Meet Dick Barton. Dick, Jock Anderson, I was telling you about.
How are you, Jock?
Barton.
Alec McCrindle is now well into his 70s, but seems, like others from the Barton cast, to have discovered the secret of eternal youth. He lives in Perth and travels to London once a month to attend actors' union meetings. We met over a drink, and he told me why he deserted Mr. Barton for a time early in the series.
I decided that I didn't want to be thought forevermore as Jock Anderson. I had interests in stage, I had interests in films, I had interests in television, and I didn't want that to interfere with these other activities.
And yet you came back fairly quickly. Do you remember the circumstances under which you came back?
Yes, I do, very vividly. I was fired by the BBC as the highest paid reporter they'd ever employed, and I had to go back to Dick Barton.
When you were doing Dick Barton, did you think that it would become the kind of, if you like, folklore that Dick Barton has become?
Oh, no. I just thought it was another short engagement that I had done dozens of for the BBC since the middle of the 30s. And I was astonished when it became the longest-running feature the BBC had ever done.
Are you still identified in some way with Jock Anderson after, what, nearly half a century?
Not quite so much as I am with my role in the film Star Wars. People tend to think of me as the General Dodona, the Commander-in-Chief of the Rebel Army. But now and again, the older people do remember me as Jock and refer to it.
What do you think was the essential magic of Dick Barton that's caused him to live in people's minds for half a century and will beyond, of course?
I think it was all a great lark. I mean, what child could resist the kind of antics that we got up to? You know, we were there, we were on top of a building, saying, right, Mr. Barton, you're ready. Right, take a jump now, off we go. Right, away, Snowy, come on. You know, that's...
Well, now, there's the voice, because obviously I was quite disappointed when I first spoke to you that you didn't have Jock Anderson's voice. You had to assume a Scottish accent to play the role of Jock Anderson.
Oh, yes, indeed, yes, because... most of the characters I was playing in other fields were not.
If Dick Barton were to come back, would you be prepared to play Jock?
Oh, for God's sake, not at my age. Thank you for thinking of it, though.
Jock Anderson, according to legend, had been a sergeant in the 51st Highland Division. Snowy White had been a sergeant too, but serving under Dick Barton in the Commandos. Snowy, John Mann then, died in 1981 and is remembered with great affection by everyone who was connected with Dick Barton. His widow, a Belfast girl, lives in Beckenham. Margaret remembers how he faded from professional acting.
He carried on, you know, he had various parts and various things for a time, but they were getting less, and so he decided to pack it in, and he turned over into the insurance, marine insurance, and... He did a lot of amateur acting after that, enjoyed doing that. I think that's why he stayed on a year longer at work. He didn't want to leave.
He was only 66 when he died. What were the circumstances?
He had been to the doctor and had been to the hospital. He was told that he was going to be sent on to the Middlesex Hospital, but he was told to keep active, keep his brain active, and so on. And so, although I didn't want him to continue, he did. But on the way back from this rehearsal, apparently, he left the rehearsal and he collapsed on when he reached London Bridge Station. That's all I ever knew. He was dead when he went to Guy's.
If there was one thing to be said about Barton, the programme was fast. Producer Neil Tewson.
I decided it was going to be the fastest thing on radio. And that's why the Devil's Gallop fitted it. Because you think of a tune that goes faster than the Devil's Gallop. It was that, and also, it had the cliffhanger, and, you know, there was a thing about this. In the studios, the announcer used to say, will Dick Barton do so-and-so? Will he get out? And in the control room, we used to say, yes, of course he will, you chubbies, aren't he's on tomorrow night.
If this mysterious ticking is the hidden timing device, can they do anything about it, or is it too late? Listen tomorrow night to Dick Barton, Special Agent.
I had an American over as an exchange producer. He sat in the studio, and when the recording was done, he turned round and he said, "Gee, Mr. Toussaint, that was fast." So when he said Toussaint, I looked round for the Chinaman, but there wasn't one there. I said, "What do you mean, fast? You Americans do things much faster than we do in old England." He said, "No, gee, no, 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 we don't. We don't go as fast as that." I said, "Well, give me an example." So he said, "Right." He said, "For example, if a man's been shaved on Monday, that water's still hot on Friday."
Pace was the thing. Noel Johnson and I listened in BBC Sound Archives to the early Barton.
I'm amazed that apparently he knows what he's talking about. It comes over as so sincerely, which I sounds like a line shoot, but I take it as a compliment to myself. And I'm also surprised at the speed one achieved. I remember years later when I was recording Terence Rattigan's last play for radio, Terence Rattigan, the late Terence Rattigan, said to Norman Wright, who was producing, "This man who's playing this council, can he go fast?" And Norman Wright roared with laughter and said, "He's probably about the fastest actor on radio."
"The next heavy emplacement with that bow, you'll take it to the rush."
"Okay, sir, but don't overdo it."
"Oh, don't worry. I'll stop firing before you run into it."
Right, you see, that's how fast you were.
Yes, I know. I certainly couldn't do it today.
"Sorry. Then hang on to what we've taken, like grim death till the ship's drawing."
"Okay. We're covering every exit from below anyway. Nothing can come up from between decks."
"Fine. See you later. I'm going to have a look for our friend Fiver."
So how do you feel about listening to it now?
Nostalgic.
The pace was aided by sound effects. Most were done in the studio. Some had to be on disc. There was the blood-curdling car crash.
"Never mind my face, it's this car that worries me. Look out, driver, look out! Gee, mine!"
And there were the riotous fight scenes.
You get a line, "I'll get you, Dick Barton." Well, you see, what I did was to get the artists to go round the microphone, literally walk round the microphone and hit themselves as they were talking. So "I'll get you, Dick Barton" became "I'll get you, Dick Barton."
"Then bill away from them, Henrietta. Schneider, Schwartz,
Schmidt. All right. There's more like it. Come on, my lady.
Oh, lovely. Right in the breath.
Oh, I'm getting you.
Lovely. Keep you right on in
the fine job. Don't do whatever. Oh, your words were good. Are you silly old man, Captain? You should have stayed.
What's up there? No.
Good work. Only one death.
I'll show you how to.
Tie them up while they are out.
Good enough. That took enough of you. 10 men onto 3.
Pace apart, there was the nightly cliffhanger. Boys and girls in playgrounds, city gents on tube trains, all speculated as to how Dick, Jock and Snowy might escape tonight. Neil Tewson refereed the war of the scriptwriters.
Because they used to have a little battle with themselves. Because Ted Mason was the first writer and Geoffrey Webb took over. Not took over from him, but the two worked together, you see. But there was a lot of fun about it because dear old Ted Mason would leave Dick Barton in a hell of a situation and more or less say, with his thumbs up, you know, his fingers to his nose, "All right, Jeff, get him out of that one." And that's how it was left from month to month because it was a monthly episode, you see. 20 episodes in a month. We used to record 2 on a Monday, 2 on a Tuesday and 1 on a Wednesday. We used the old Grafton studio, which is an old theatre in Tottenham Court Road. And there's a lovely story about that studio. I wanted a girl to scream on echo, so we decided to put her in the echo chamber. And this is on for page 4. And we got through to about page 2 and a bit, and suddenly there was the most hell of a bloody scream I've ever heard in my life. And I put the talk back down. I said, "Darling, not yet, you're too early." She said, "Neil, but there's a rat in here."
So the scream was genuine enough.
The scream was genuine enough, but not in the right place. So that was another disc scrapped, I'm afraid.
The great days came and went. The BBC claimed that the audience dropped from 15 millions to only 2 millions after the programme was moved to the earlier time of 6:15 in 1950. The prudish climate of the times and the enormous children audience conspired against Barton. Anything remotely smacking of bad language had to be expunged.
"What the devil is planned to, sir?"
"Blessed if I know, but I don't feel like staying here to find out. Come on."
"Will you, sir?"
"No, wait a tick, Snowy. It's plain madness to dash across this open warehouse. It's too exposed. There's no cover."
But there's the entrance over there. Let's make a dash.
"Don't be a twerp, Snowy."
twerp, because the BBC couldn't track down its derivation, had to go. And this was soon forbidden.
I could do with a drink.
Jean.
Okay,
yes, sir. Ambulance coming right away. And I've brought some brandy from the first aid chest.
Oh, that was thoughtful.
Thank you, Pat, sir.
Well, I mean, girls don't usually think of these things. The brandy, sir.
Thanks.
You remarked about girls. You don't seem to know much about them.
Take a swig of this, Archie. It's better.
So was Barton watered down in such a way that he became feeble? Neil Tewson.
Not really. It became very gradual, that. Because, you see, when you're in the middle of a fight, you don't stop off and have a quick noggin, do you? You know, it didn't really matter so much whether he drank or not. I didn't notice it. I wasn't aware of it. I knew it was happening, but it didn't really show, as we say, in the script.
So you don't think that that had the effect of leading to the demise of Dick Barton as a radio character?
No, I think, I'm not sure about this, but I think the then head of drama, Val Gielgud, decided it wasn't the right thing to be broadcast. I think he thought, mind you, this is my own opinion, I think he thought that it was a bad influence on the youth of Britain, but then everybody's been saying everything that's on radio or television since has been a bad influence on the youth of Britain. I don't think it means a toughening damn what's on radio or television. The youth of Britain will behave as it's going to behave anyway.
Dick Barton, as inexorably as the rhythm of the Devil's Gallop, was removed from the airways in favour of a new serial. What was it called again? The Archers. But even the BBC didn't have the nerve to kill our hero off. He got his Z Reserve papers and was thus recalled to the army.
Snowy, I've got a letter here for Dick. Give it to him in a minute.
Well, what are your plans now, chaps?
Well, in October 1946, we started something that grew beyond our wildest dreams. We started our own almost private war. It's been a war against crime. We've given you some headaches, Burke, and I'd like to thank you for your help and understanding.
Yeah.
The pace has quickened up right through the past 6 years, and we think we need a rest.
Yep, yeah. We certainly do.
We've made a lot of friends and a few enemies, but we've tried to stick to the rules. So now we're going to take a good long holiday and sort things out.
Oh, excuse me, sir. There's a letter here for you.
Set it up, Snowy.
Oh, I can't do that.
If it's somebody wanting another job done...
It is.
Give it to me.
Stop! 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 It's from the War Office.
What?
Haven't you forgotten, sir? You're a Zed man. They're calling you up.
The third Dick Barton, Gordon Davis, remembers the end.
We were recording at Maida Vale, and that was the end. My option wasn't taken up. They were closing the programme, and that was it. I mean, there was no particular feeling of one thing or another. We had a lovely party that night, I recall, a super party, actually, and that was it.
But was that it? Was that the end of Dick Barton, Special Agent? What could replace it? Surely not an everyday story of country folk. Can Dan Archer succeed? Listen to BBC Radio 4.
While you catch your breath, let me remind you that Still a Special Agent was presented by John Hoskin and featured Noel Johnson, Duncan Cast, Gordon Davis, the three Dick Bartons, and Alex McCrindle, who played Jock Anderson. We also heard Neil Tewson, the original producer, and Pat Hetherington, fan extraordinaire. The programme was produced at Pebble Mill by Jock Gallagher, who, by the way, reminisces about Dick Barton in an article in The Listener, out tomorrow.